Yeah.
I'll call the meeting to order. We do have a forum.
And we have minutes from March 5th. Somebody would like to move those.
So move, sir, Chairman.
Representative McDonald moves the minutes from March 5th. Any discussion? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? None. So the minutes are approved. And on the agenda today is the updated fiscal both from Human Services, and Dr. Hoffman is here. Call him by his formal title. Welcome to the committee, Mr. Hoffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, members, George Hoffman, Department of Human Services. I will be referring to two documents. One is about a 20-page document, our usual narrative description of the changes in the forecast. And the other is a one-pager that starts February forecast changes. And I will be talking initially off the one-pager. What I thought I would do, since we have rolled the effects of the expansion bill, which was passed in the law, that has been rolled into the February forecast, and so I thought I would break that out of the February forecast for you, because the effects are fairly large and explain a lot of the movement in the February forecast, especially in the healthcare access fund. So if you look at the top row of numbers on the single sheet, you'll see that the net general fund change in our February forecast was a decrease of $45 million in the current biennium, a decrease of $80 million in the next biennium, and an increase of $108 million in the 16-17 biennium. If we back out the, I've then given you a breakdown of the changes in the February forecast based on the passage of the bill. And the first row of those numbers is the additional cost for MA children and parents. And this is the cost of the expansion for MA parents and for 19 and 20-year-olds in the medical assistance program. And we have a cost here because these groups do not count as new eligibles under the federal rules for the Medicaid expansion. We get 100% federal funding for 3 years for quote new eligibles, and so that applies to the medical assistance adults without dependent children, but it does not apply to the parents and the 19 and 20-year-olds, because we had what the feds consider existing Medicaid coverage of those people in the expansion income bracket in the Minnesota Care program. We were covering up to that income level, and we were drawing federal matching money. So as far as the federal government is concerned, we had pre-existing Medicaid coverage of those groups, and so when we expand eligibility, we only get the regular federal match for the parents and the 19 and 20-year-olds. The next row is the cost to the state for the expansion for adults without children. The federal government pays 100% for the first 3 years, calendar year 14, 15, 16. in calendar year 17, the state has a 5% share. The feds pay 95%. And so the $8.9 million cost shown here is the 5% state share for the last several months of fiscal year 17. We do get some benefit in the chemical dependency fund for the expansion of MA coverage and for the 100% federal funding of a large part of that coverage. And most of this comes in the form of increased dedicated revenue from the federal reimbursement fund. So subtracting those effects from the change in the total February forecast, we get to a general fund change without the MA expansion effects, and that's about $45 million in the current biennium, $142 million in the next biennium, and $13 million in the 16-17 biennium. Now, the reason for this is a net of fairly small changes, less than 1% averaged overall. There are a couple of things that cause the 16-17 number to look different from the 14-15 savings, and one of them is a technical a fix of a technical error. This was mentioned in the MMB narrative on the forecast changes. We do a month-by-month forecast, and we put managed care. We need to put managed care payments into the right months. We have a fairly complex situation regarding managed care. We, under the current law, we never pay for the June coverage in managed care until the following fiscal year. At the end of the biennium, we don't pay for May 13 or for May 15 until the following fiscal year. And in the case of the capitation product for the disabled, we don't normally pay for May until the following fiscal year. And in 13 or 15, we don't pay for April until the following fiscal year. Now we had a mistake in our spreadsheet putting the right payments in the right months. We had one too many payments in fiscal 15. We were short two payments in fiscal 16. So the fix of that change is a state reduction of $20 million in the 14-15 biennium and an increase of $40 million in the 16-17 biennium. So that by itself accounts for a $60 million difference between the bottom line for 14 and 15 and the bottom line for 16 and 17. It's purely a technical change. That is, this isn't based on any change in enrollment or payment amounts, but it does make these numbers look a little different. Another factor contributing to the difference is in this forecast, we increase expected dedicated revenue from the pharmacy rebates. We started only a little more than a year ago being able to bill. We have long been billing pharmacy manufacturers for rebates on medical assistance's fee-for-service pharmacy business. A little more than a year ago, we started being able to also bill for the rebates on the managed care pharmacy business. And we did a substantial increase in expected rebates I think about a year and a half ago, and we have taken another couple steps. We increased forecasted rebates from this in November, and we're doing an additional increase. I think we now have a satisfactory model to forecast how much these rebates are going to be. And part of the change in the February is recognizing the high pharmacy utilization of the adults without children. And so recognizing that, we have increased the forecast of managed care pharmacy rebates, and the effect on the 14-15 forecast is a decrease of $59 million. So we're anticipating $59 million more in the state share of rebate revenue. And this comes largely from the adults without children. There is much less effect in 16 and 17 because the adults without children start to be 100% federally financed. And when the feds have paid 100% for the cost of care, they will also take 100% of the pharmacy rebates for the corresponding period. The difference in the change in the pharmacy rebate forecast accounts for about another $40 million of difference between the bottom line for 14 and 15 and the bottom line 16 and 17.
Mr. Hoffman, could you explain, we're paying a capitated rate to the health plans that do the managed care, and how does that rebate relate to what we're paying them? Does that run through the health plans, or is it, or just show up in our budget?
We get encounter data from the health plans on the pharmacy claims, so we know what the pharmacy product was that was purchased by the health plan under the capitation coverage, and we initially held off budgeting pharmacy rebates from the managed care business because we thought that the health plans would be losing substantial rebates of their own. And it proved not to be true that there was much impact on the rebates affected by the health plans. And so we the medical assistance program, have been able to build the pharmacy rebates for the managed care business directly to the pharmacy manufacturers and to get the rebates back. Now, as always, when we get something like that, if the feds have paid 50% for the coverage, the feds get 50% of the rebates. But the state share of the rebates is what I'm talking about. So we are able to bill directly and to get the rebates and take our share.
Representative Abler has a question.
Well, thanks. I Mr. Chair, I don't know how Mr. Hoffman keeps this in his head. I just can't remember numbers from year to year. And this, you talked earlier about the shifts that we did, and just thinking again there, I'm suddenly probably as happy for a hiatus 2 years ago not having to find the $1 billion. So, yeah, you're welcome. But in your balancing $1 billion, we did do some shifts and delays. Were those one time, like the 13 and the 15, where we crossed the biennial thing? Is there a 17 one coming?
The delay of May capitation payments is only 13 and 15. It is not permanent. So that part goes away. The delay of June is permanently in statute.
And Mr. Chair,
Representative,
and you mentioned the April one. That was also a one-time thing that we did.
Well, Mr. Chairman, Representative Abler, in the case of the disabled capitation product, it's April instead of May. And so the April delay in 13 and 15 also ends after, is not continuing, is not permanent.
Thanks. And Mr. Chair, just to, I tried to avoid shifts in our work. I came in with $50 million and left with more. I don't remember if when we left the House if we had much shifts. I don't know that we did. But I tried to avoid them, and I'm happy that they were one time. But they did buy us some time, and if you look at the forecast coming in the future, things are, you know, we were able to make the cost sustainable. So I was kind of, it bought us time. So it's not a tool I recommend using a lot, but it did cause a little hardship on a few of the smaller providers. But thanks for the recap. I appreciate it.
And Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Hoffman, or maybe even to Mr. Chun. So we're really deep in the weeds here, of course. With Mr. Hoffman, you can really get deep in the weeds, and that's, I'm struggling to understand this, but I want to back us up a lot because I just want to make sure that we all understand more, that I understand exactly what we're talking about here. So talking about the pharmacy rebates, so maybe it would be better, I just want to ask for a sort of a backing up to explain what those are, and maybe Mr. Chun would be the one. I don't know if Mr. Hoffman doesn't want to, he's more our numbers guy, but just to explain what these are, what is this money coming from and why are we getting it?
Mr. Hoffman, do you want to answer? Or
Mr. Chairman, I think I can answer that. I'm not sure quite when it started. It's been in place for many years. That maybe as long as 15 years that we have been able to bill the pharmacy manufacturers for a rebate, a fairly high level of rebate on our fee-for-service pharmacy business. And currently, the rebates amount to between 35% and 40% of what we spend on fee-for-service pharmacy business. And we show the pharmacy rebates as a line in our detailed forecast, and it's a negative because money is coming back. It's dedicated revenue. It offsets the cost to the state of the medical assistance program. And so it's basically, when we say we're changing the forecast for the pharmacy rebates, what we are changing is that line where we recognize the value of the pharmacy rebates. And so if we forecast a higher level of rebates, then we have a corresponding decrease in the state share of the medical assistance forecast. A provision of the, I think it was the Accountable Care Act, provided that Medicaid programs, in addition to getting rebates for their fee-for-service pharmacy business, can also claim a rebate for the managed care pharmacy business. And so it took a while for all the necessary federal clarification to be in place, but about a year and a half ago, we started being able to bill for the managed care pharmacy rebates, and we recognized, as soon as we knew that was happening, we recognize a substantial increase in pharmacy rebates in the medical assistance forecast, and we were cautious about it at first because we didn't have any experience yet, and we weren't. It was going to create a big swing in the forecast, and it did. But subsequently, we have some experience with the billing of the rebates, and we can see how much money is coming in, and so we have increased the forecast of the rebate amounts a couple of times now, in November and in the current February forecast.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Hoffman. I understood everything you said, but what I was looking for was something even more basic than that, and maybe Mr. Chun, because the real question I have, and that was very helpful, but the real question I have is, who are we billing, and why are they giving us a rebate? Okay.
Mr. Chun.
Mr. Chair, members, I think the rebates were set up as sort of a deal between the federal government and the drug companies some while back. Say 15 years ago or so, the Medicaid programs, state Medicaid programs, had, you know, formularies where they wouldn't include every drug of a manufacturer on that formulary. And I think the agreement was that in exchange for states, in a sense, having an open formulary, a drug manufacturer, in order to have their drugs included on the formulary, and this would then be, you know, all of their range of drugs, would receive a rebate. And this rebate was tied to, you know, the best price or the lowest price that the manufacturer sold the drug, with some exceptions, you know, from certain buyers.
Representative Liebling.
So thank you, Mr. Chair. And just so I think what I understood here, just to be even more simple about it, maybe too simple about it, is that basically the feds, or we, use our buying power with the drug companies from whom we get pharmaceuticals to say, if you want to sell to us, you have to give us some rebates. We're not going to buy at full price. And this is somewhat negotiated, I understand. But that's kind of it, that otherwise we would be. So when we talk about billing, Mr. Hoffman said a few times we bill for this. Who gets billed? Is it the drug companies that get billed that we get this money back from?
Mr. Hoffman.
What we do, Mr. Chairman, what we do, most of the rebates are set, and for a given product, any Medicaid program will get the same amount of rebate. What we do, when I said billing, what we do is we send data to the pharmacy manufacturers telling them how much of each of their products we have paid for, and then they apply the appropriate pharmacy rebates to each of these individual we look at the data on the products, and we have the information what the rebate is for each product, and so we calculate, but I think we also share the data with the pharmacy manufacturer and say, here's what we bought, and here's what the rebates are that accrue based on the purchases we made. So I think we do actually bill. I think we actually do the calculation of what they owe us, and then they of course do their own check on what they think they owe based on those products, on the purchase of those products. But it's the pharmacy manufacturers who are paying. Are paying the rebates.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't want to pull you too far up track. I know I already have, but I just thought it'd be important to understand what we're talking about so everybody knows what it is. Thanks.
This is a good example of how we've created the most complex healthcare system in the world. Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I also appreciate getting a little bit more up to speed on the pay for listing formulary thing that's involved, and if PPACA has some additional changes, or the exchange has some additional changes, it might be nice to let the committee know of, you know, some of these side deals that come with these packages. But even though Representative Abler took my main question about the the shifts, I'm still looking through. I'm seeing several notes, like on page 12 of the HMO rate rates being lower than the November forecast, and you know, other notes in there, looking at the graph on page 20 and the you know, updates to the enrollment. For clarification, is this totally aligned with the February data, or are there any other variances from the February that we could anticipate, you know, coming out of this?
Okay, Mr. Hoffman, I know you're going to go through this bigger sheet later, but if you could answer Mr. or Representative Vaughn's question, that would be helpful.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Quam, the roughly 20-page document is a tabulation and explanation of the changes made in the February forecast that went into the state forecast update. So there isn't anything new or different here from the February forecast. It's a description of the February forecast changes.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Hoffman, continue.
I'll move on to begin on the single page. Healthcare Access Fund total changes was an increase of $17 million. This is in the middle of the sheet. Current biennium increase of $17 million. 14-15 biennium decrease of $196 million. 16-17 biennium decrease of $390 million. Most of this change in 14-15, 16-17 is the effects of the expansion bill. If we take out the effects of that bill, then we get a decrease of $4 million in the 14-15 biennium forecast, and a decrease of $70 million in the 16-17 biennium forecast. Most of the $70 million comes from a decrease in the enrollment forecast for the adults without children in the Minnesota Care program. If you turn the page over, you will see a summary of the enrollment changes, which were part of the expansion bill changes. In fiscal year 14, you have a six-month effect averaged over 12. And so the increase of average monthly enrollment of adults without children that says 12,000 means we're forecasting an average of 24,000 enrollment for a six-month period, because that's when the change starts, January of 14. And so after that, that will make more sense with the numbers following, that the average is actually 24,000, and then it goes up to 34 and about 41,000 after that. For the numbers for the expansion for the parents and the 19-year-olds are a bit smaller. When you look at the Minnesota Care effects, you'll see that about half of what we're forecasting as expansion for adults without children, at least in the longer term, about half of it is enrollment we figured that is coming out of the Minnesota Care population. It's half, at least in 16 and 17, roughly half, more than half in 14 and 15. And then you'll notice that the Minnesota Care effect on parents in 19 and 20s is quite small compared to the increase in medical assistance. The reason for this is that the expansion bill left open people's ability to stay in the Minnesota Care program, and so we assumed in the case of the parents and the 19 and 20-year-olds, we assumed that 90% of them would stay in the Minnesota Care program if they had that as an option. So the the effect on enrollment of parents and 19 years old in Minnesota care is quite small compared to the medical assistance expansion. So we are treating the two groups differently. We're assuming that practically all of the adults with no dependent children will move over to medical assistance, but we're assuming that only 10% of the parents will opt to move over to medical assistance. Part of the reason for that is our experience in the early expansion is that practically all the adults moved over to medical assistance, although DHS couldn't force them to. But when we, 10 years ago, did a big expansion of income coverage for children in medical assistance, expanding considerably the range of eligibility for children, most of the Minnesota care population stayed put in Minnesota care and did not move over to medical assistance. And so we, because the bill left the choice of Minnesota care open, we assumed that only 10% of the parents and 19 and 20 year olds moved over to medical assistance. If we get a subsequent law change saying that if you're eligible for medical assistance, that's your only choice, we will account for the movement of the other 90% of parents and 19 years old. We will assume that the cost is the same, that we will save in Minnesota care, that they will cost us in MA the same as they will save us in Minnesota care, except for the difference in premiums. They pay a premium which offsets their costs by probably 6 or 8%. They pay premiums in Minnesota care, and of course they will not be paying premiums in medical assistance.
And Mr. Hoffman, some of this forecast then is dependent on the waiver that we now have for Minnesota care from the feds, but isn't that supposed to expire? And we don't know if it's going to be renewed or not.
We are... we're sort of getting into the weeds a bit, Mr. Chairman, but since the chair asked the question, our waiver providing Medicaid funding for children, parents, pregnant women, and lately adults without children expires December 31st, 2013. In forecasting how much federal matching we were going to get on the Minnesota Care Program in the February forecast, we assumed federal matching was going to continue to be available for the children because we have a maintenance of effort obligation. We could and we assume the feds will still be obligated to match the cost for children. On the parents and 19 and 20 year olds, we assumed we would get federal match. On the part of the population up to MA eligibility level, up to the MA income level, and on the part above the current MA income level, we assumed we would not get a federal match in Minnesota care.
Thank you. And Representative Aber has a question.
I have lots, but I'm trying to keep them limited. I love math, Mr. Chair. This is discreet. We ran the kids off. I was going to tell the students that stopped in, this is where we actually use math, and we we throw out six digits and just talk about millions and, you know, billions. And but anyway, two questions. One, on the enrollment part, why you said that there were only a few want to move over to the MA. Why would they not want to move over?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Abler, because they already have an equivalent benefit, and some people feel like if they're in a program where they pay a premium, that's more respectable than medical assistance.
Interesting. And then my other question, we don't have a sheet on the Healthcare Access Fund summary. The money we saved in the expansion was mostly Healthcare Access Fund, sounds like. And so is, and that's an MMB question, but do you know if that's all being carried, all this increase is being carried as a surplus in the Healthcare Access Fund, and is it close to being the kind of surplus that would give us a reduction if we didn't spend it in the rate?
Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Hoffman.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Abler, I'm not sure. I think we've seen a Healthcare Access Fund balance for the February forecast. I think maybe it's available, but I have not looked at it.
Okay. And Mr. Chair,
Representative Abler.
So in the governor's budget where he proposed to do the expansion, did he spend the Healthcare Access Fund on items or refinance it somehow? Do you know that?
Mr. Hawk.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Abler, I know the governor did some refinancing to pay for the various expansions to limit or to keep down the general fund cost of it.
But Mr.
I think we transferred, I'm not sure, that was like $160 million that we transferred from the Healthcare Access Fund to the general fund, so there's no net cost for the expansion in the general fund. There is still a cost in the Healthcare Access Fund, but there is also very large savings in the Healthcare Access Fund.
And so, yeah, maybe I'll just ask my question different. And so, short of the expansion costs, I mean, if that's just a project that's getting done and there's some net savings and there's some costs you have to pay for out of that, would the remaining surplus from the remaining healthcare access dollar surpluses that come out of that, was some of that spent for other purposes besides the expansion? Do you know that, Mr. Hoffman?
Mr. Hoffman.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Abler, I think that's that. I mean, we can look at the Healthcare Access Fund balance, although I don't have it to show you at this point. But as to spending money, that's going to be an issue for the governor's budget update, which is not out yet, is not fully decided yet.
All right. Mr. Chair, what I'm getting at is that
Mr. Berg might have.
Oh, yeah, okay. And I don't want to drag it out.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Abler, I do have a copy of the February forecast Healthcare Access Fund balance, which I can distribute to the members. I think, and it does show in 14 a projected surplus of $163.4 million and in 15 of $293 million. To answer one of your specific questions, if that balance were not spent in some way during the biennium, it would be large enough to trigger the rate reduction that is part of the law that gets rid of that sick tax if it's not used for some other purpose. Separately, I would note this is a current law fund balance which does not look at the governor's budget recommendation. The governor did have a budget recommendation that involved a new Minnesota Care demonstration waiver that was going to use healthcare access funds. I think because of subsequent federal direction that they aren't going to be moving forward with a basic health plan model for a year or two at least, that the governor is probably going to rework that recommendation. but I can certainly distribute the current WA
healthcare fund access fund balance to the members.
Thank you. That's helpful.
And I will say that the I did actually I couldn't attend it, but there was a meeting with Human Services about the, what we're going to do with Minnesota Care, and I think there will be some recommendations to make some changes in Minnesota Care in the short run.
The hospital, yeah.
Thank you. Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Hoffman, I'm wondering with, you know, adults from with no children moving from Minnesota Care to MA, if that's going to change the mix, the risk mix within MA sufficient enough to influence the bidding process. I suspect these are tend to be younger people than, you know, most of the adults without children in MA being seniors right now or people with severe disabilities, and whether or not we could expect to see a different payment rate based on the mix than changing, since we have always set the rates, I think, differently for Minnesota Care versus MA, but I'm not necessarily clear on the new system.
Mr. Hoffman.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Loeffler, we make capitation rates by different eligibility groups, and so the disabled capitation for SMBC, which is the name of the product, that is separate, and the capitation rates for the adults without kids are a separate program group, and similarly for the children and parents and the elderly. So what we're seeing is expansion adding modestly to the enrollment of parents and adding substantially to the enrollment of adults without dependent children. Now, for the group coming into adults without children, because they're a somewhat higher income stratum, I would figure they would probably be somewhat less expensive than the existing adults without children group. And so that's where I think there might be an effect on the capitation rates.
And just to follow up, Mr. Chair and Mr. Hoffman, and would we need to do legislation to really understand that potential impact on the rates, or is that something that we could? I'm just feeling like we may once again be in a situation where we're looking for every nickel of savings we can get, and if the mix has changed and it is a less demanding population, that it would be nice if we could base our budget on the new mix rather than the old mix.
Mr. Hoffman.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Loeffler, we just dropped the rates for that group by 5%, and future increases are capped at, I think, 3%. So I wouldn't be very enthusiastic about assuming we can do with less than a 3% increase from 3% in the next rates are going to be 2014. Those are capped at a 3% increase. So I don't think there's any savings to book there.
Okay, and Mr. Hoffman, if you would to continue, because we do have a bill coming up later.
The other changes in medical assistance, I'm not going to go through the document. The net changes are small. The nursing home forecast is down a little bit, less than 1%. The forecast for waivers is down a little bit, mostly less than 1%. And so most of the rest of the changes net are fairly small. There is a lot of detail in the document about a lot of ups and downs, but the net comes to a pretty small decrease in the forecast. And I would propose to leave it at that, Mr. Chairman, unless there are other questions.
Okay, are there any further questions for Mr. Hoffman? I don't see any, so thank you, Mr. Hoffman, for your presentation. And as usual, very illuminating.
You're
and,
welcome, Mr. Chairman.
We're going to go on then with the, although I will say, Representative Loeffler, when we went from 0 to 75% of poverty for medical assistance, the big chunk of those people weren't close to 75%. They were down even lower. That's because they were sicker than the general population. The new population from 138%, is a different income status, probably a different healthcare status. So they're, I think you're kind of correct that we may have to look at that. Mm-hmm. Thank you, Mr. Hoffman. Okay, next we're Representative Dabney is not here yet, so. Okay, he should be here in 2 minutes. So we'll take a little bit of a break right now.
Okay, we're going to start
with House File 353, and the chief author is not here yet, but Representative Abler is the number two author, so and he's a member of this committee, so he can move House File 353.
Yeah. And Mr. Chair, I'd like to offer my own version of the motion if I could offer for certain inclusion in the omnibus out of the motion. But I think I'll just do the more traditional motion if possible. And then when Representative Dabney comes, I'll yield to him and he can take my chair here. So, but I do have some witnesses. I don't know who, but there's some. Here's one.
Could you, or do you want Ms. Afterholden to explain the bill?
I'll defer to the witnesses, Mr. Chair.
Okay.
It's a great bill. We should pass it.
My work is done.
This bill, I believe, was heard in Policy Committee?
Yes.
So, okay, Ms. Afterholden, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Sue Afterholden with NAMI Minnesota. The bill is really very straightforward. Basically, all it does is appropriate funding for the schooling to mental health services. And I'll turn it back over to Representative Abler.
Whatever Representative Abler said, is that a good answer at this time, Mr. Chair?
Yeah, that would be a good thing because he did move. I'm going to have to change his. He moved to. We usually say for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill, and he moved it for certain inclusion.
I can go with that, Mr. Chair.
So anyway, we just started, and Mr. Abdeholden has been talking maybe 30 seconds before you got here.
Thank you, Ms. Abdeholden. Thank you, Mr. Chair. My apologies. I got down here as soon as I got the heads up. I think members in this committee are well aware of the existing SchoolLink Mental Health grant program. It's providing services in schools in 65 of Minnesota's 87 counties. One of the metro area counties is not included, Anoka, which is striking because the state's largest school district is there. And then a number of the greater Minnesota counties, about 21 of them, I guess, out of the 80, also do not currently have these services. That said, the department did fund all but one of the grants that were applied for with the existing money. So community partners who applied for the grants received them statewide with one exception. The House File 353 would both expand the program and focus on schools where there is a high level of high percentage of special education students with an EBD status, high poverty, or those with high use of prone restraints.
That, again, that 25% emphasis is on the new money. So the base would continue distributed as it is, and 75% of the new money, as proposed in House File 353, would continue to be distributed in that same way, but expand the program for these services for students and families.
Ms. Adler-Holder.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. As you all know, about 21% of children between the ages of 9 and 17 have a diagnosable mental illness or substance use disorder, but only 20% actually receive treatment. And we know that if these young people don't get treatment, their ability to do well in school and at home is really compromised. We know that children with a mental illness have higher suspension rates. They do poorly in school. They have one of the highest dropout rates. And, of course, in the juvenile justice system, 70% have one or more mental health diagnoses. So intervening early and really helping them succeed really makes a lot of sense. The other thing I will mention is that roughly half of all adults who live with a serious mental illness begin exhibiting symptoms or experiencing them before the age of 14. So there's been a lot of talk, you know, at the Capitol about how can we intervene early. Well, you have to start then. If we wait until they're adults, we've actually lost a lot of time. Families face a whole lot of barriers in accessing mental health treatment. Their insurance may not cover mental health treatment, which, of course, will change under the exchange. Parity, I want to remind people, doesn't require coverage. It just says if you cover it, you have to do it in the same way. Families may face high deductibles. They may not have insurance at all. They also might face barriers in terms of transportation. In greater Minnesota, being able to travel all the way to the school to pick your child up, then 60 miles to where the nearest mental health provider may be, and then bring them back to school, that can be a huge barrier. Some families really can't take off of work every week for 22 weeks. They'll lose their job, and so that really prevents them from accessing treatment for their child. And then there's a long waiting list to get in. We had a hearing on another bill related to workforce issues in the mental health field, and what we know is all but two of the regions of the state have severe shortages. So families often face really long waiting lists. These school-linked mental health services, I just want to remind you, came out of the 2007 Mental Health Initiative, which was a bipartisan approach of, you know, provided promoted by a Republican governor and adopted by a Democratic legislature. So this has really been a bipartisan effort all along. The grants are provided to mental health providers, so these do not go to the school. We do not expect schools to be providing clinical mental health treatment. That's not their role. So the grants go to the mental health providers, who then collaborate with the school so they can provide those mental health services on site. They do things like diagnostic assessments, individual family therapy, group therapy, skills training, medication management, etc. They can then bill the private insurance or Medicaid or Minnesota Care, and then the grant money is used to fund the services that are not reimbursed, such as family psychoeducation, the collaboration that may go on with the teachers and others, and also things like care coordination. Another benefit of this model, and it really is viewed as a national model, is that FERPA, which are the education records, trumps HIPAA, our healthcare records. And many families really want to keep their healthcare records, their child's healthcare records, separate from their educational records. So this is another good way to do it because we're able to keep them separate. I do have a handout here, and two of them actually. One of the people who wanted to testify couldn't come, so they wrote a letter instead. So from July 2008 until December 2011, we served a little over 13,000 children, which I think is amazing. And what we found is that half of them had never received services before, and half of those children had a serious emotional disturbance. So it's kind of one of those, you go, well, of course they're not doing well in school. We have adults even with, you know, with serious depression who aren't able to work. And here we have these kids who have a serious emotional disturbance. How would they do well in school without access to treatment? The referrals, just so you know, are made by a variety of people, including regular ed teachers, special ed teachers, the student support personnel, the family, crisis staff, county staff, and even primary care. So everyone sees it as a way to get the kids into treatment. What was interesting for us is that general education teachers were the most likely to refer a child who had never received services before. I'll just close by saying on the handout, so you can see you know, kind of the information. 85% of students were seen once face-to-face, 70% within 10 days, which is really a very short period of time and very different than what most families experience. We did see in the Minneapolis School District a decrease in school suspension rates for children who are receiving treatment. So again, the more we keep kids in school, the better that they're able to do. This is just a reminder of one of the 12 children's mental health bills that we are bringing forward this year, and we think this is really the cornerstone of it. We simply have to identify kids, get them into treatment early, so that they really will go on and do well in their life. And we think, frankly, this is the best thing since sliced bread. And I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Any questions for Ms. Apterholder? Representative Fisher.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. One question I have is, I know that so often working with people on mental health issues, sometimes there's stereotypes that you run into. I'm wondering how much of a barrier that has been, and what have you been doing, or how you've been finding ways to overcome that barrier of people that might be stereotyped with mental illnesses?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Fisher, you know, the nice thing about the clinical services being provided in schools is that families usually trust schools a little bit more than they do, you know, running down to a big building that says Mental Health Center on it. The other thing is about 8 or 9 years ago, the legislature passed a bill that required teachers to get continuing education on the early warning signs of mental illness. So, and teachers are wonderful screeners. They can see what maybe is going wrong in a classroom. So now they have something they can do about it. They can refer the child, of course, with their family's permission, to get a diagnostic assessment and to get treatment if that's needed. So I think all of those things actually help to reduce the stigma surrounding mental illnesses in our schools and in our communities.
Representative Newton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Ms. Apterholder, I have a couple of questions. First of all, do you know why Anoka Hennepin's not included in this? Are they under a special program, or do you know?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Newton, I can't really answer that, but what we know is there must not have been a mental health facility that was able to get an agreement with them in order to apply for a grant.
Okay. And secondly, Ms. Apterholder, Mr. Chair, do facility costs come under this program? For example, a room for restraint or seclusion?
Ms. Apterholder.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, no. Because the collaboration with the school is providing that space for free, and actually the mental health providers are under different rules for the use of seclusion restraints than school personnel.
Thank you.
And Mr. McDonald, Representative McDonald.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Question for Ms. Aberholden. State law and federal law already require that we should do monitor their behavioral interventions and look at do some studies. What does this bill do up and above what state law and federal law currently have us doing?
Ms. Apterholder.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, so are you talking about in the schools for kids with emotional and behavioral disorders, the programs that we provide to those students there in the use of seclusion restraints, or I'm not sure I understand your question, sorry.
Representative McDonald.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Well, in regards to the IEPs, the individual education programs, so I'm just curious as to what more in this bill will that do that to the current IEPs?
Mr. Chairman, Representative McCarthy, I understand now. The thing to remember is under the IEP, we don't provide clinical mental health services because schools don't typically employ mental health professionals who can do the clinical work. There's a few exceptions, but generally, again, that's not their role. So they may be providing behavior intervention plans. They may be working with the student on some other areas, but they're not going to necessarily be providing a specific type of cognitive behavior therapy, you know, one-on-one, that type of thing. So this is an addition to it. You know, in the school world, in the education world, we talk about it's a triangle for positive behavior intervention services. And when you try to create kind of those the school-wide interventions, you catch a whole lot of the kids. Then you have some kids up at this way where their behaviors are concerning to everybody, but they're not at a really high level. And that's where our school support personnel come in, our counselors, our social workers, our school psychologists. And then there's kids at the very top of the triangle who really have, that's where the kids who have the most serious mental illnesses, and that's where this comes in. That helps that end of the top end of the triangle for the kids who have the highest needs.
Mr. Chair?
Representative McDonald, are you done? Did that answer your question?
Follow-up, it would be helpful as well, Mr. Chairman. Thank you. Then, Ms. Amber Holden, can you explain what the school-linked mental health, what exactly that is in the bill? I see this on page 1.8, children's school-linked mental health services. And you passed out some flyers regarding this, but if you could explain it to me as well and what it pertains to the bill.
Ms. Averholder.
Mr. Chairman and Representative, this is the money that goes to the mental health programs that then come into the schools and collaborate with them to provide those clinical mental health services. So this is not the schools doing it. This is the mental health, which is why we're in this committee, why the mental health providers are doing it, because that really is their role. And if a child changes schools, they can continue to follow them and continue to provide treatment.
Mr. Chairman, thank you for your indulgence. So then lastly, based on its term, the school's linked program, does this does this piggyback, so to speak, on the governor's $125 million appropriations for special education?
Mr. Chairman, Representative McDonald, no, because the special ed dollars are really for all students who have an IEP, whereas this is for kids who they may not have an IEP, but they have a mental illness. They're having difficulty in the classroom, and in some situations, maybe we avoid special education because we're actually treating their symptoms earlier and getting them the help they need before it dramatically impacts their ability to do well in school.
Representative Dabney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative McDonald, the Eden Prairie School District has deployed through the existing grant program mental health professionals in each of their elementary schools and one of their middle schools. And one of the things that they have found is a decrease in referrals to special education. So we're actually, after you and I sat in this morning on the joint House-Senate education hearing on the OLA's report on special education, seeing the growth there, this is a demonstrated strategy for reducing growth in referral to special education services because we're able to get to the kids and provide them with the services through community partners that they need. Eden Prairie also found increased attendance, and as Ms. Abderholden indicated, if you're not there, you're not learning what they're teaching you there. And then lastly, they found that 94% of the students who received school-linked or school-based mental health services improved their academic performance.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative McDonald.
Thank you. Representative Dambley, we got some great information regarding the OLA's report on special education and the funding and its recommendations. Frankly, you bring up a very good point. If we can spend dollars ahead of time to avoid that, we can save some school districts money. But doesn't it concern you that you bring a bill forward that has no fiscal note or no appropriations of any dollars, no estimate? Doesn't that concern you at all?
Representative Dabney.
Not at all. Mr. Chair, Representative McDonald, not at all. I trust you and the other members of this committee to fill in those numbers.
Where would the government trust us? Thank you.
Okay, and I think we have to get on. Thank you, Ms. Abderholden. We're now going to Mr. Burkett.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair and members.
He's part of your bill, too.
My apologies.
Dr. Burkett.
Chairman Huntley, members of the committee, my name is Tim Burkett, and I'm CEO of People Incorporated Mental Health Services, the largest provider of services to people living with mental illness in the state. Ms. Abderholden has already talked about the importance of early intervention in treating mental illness. Clinical research is very clear that the outcomes are so much better when we start working with kids early with unaddressed mental health issues. And we see the positive effects throughout their lifetimes. Some of the best early intervention opportunities are afforded via school-linked mental health services. school offers kids the first social interaction they must navigate completely on their own. And having mental health professionals in the school allows them to work directly with teachers where they can see these kids up close in everyday interactions. What's more than half the kids we serve at People Incorporated have previously gone completely without mental health treatment, meaning that their mental health challenges had previously gone unrecognized. In school mental health programs teach coping skills for depression, for anxiety, and we can work then with these kids over the long term and help facilitate successful learning in the classroom and a successful lifetime in the community. I want to give you one short example of the impact this early intervention has had in the real world. We recently worked with a client and her nephew. I'll call them Clara and Jim. Jim's mother passed away 2 years ago, and he now lives with his Aunt Clara. The death of Jim's mother was incredibly traumatic for Jim, as you can imagine. His unprocessed grief spilled out as anger toward his aunt, his teachers, and many others in his life who wanted so much to help him. Clara's determination to help him led the two of them to our school link mental health programs, or one of our school link mental health programs, that is, and over the last year, we've helped Jim to process his grief, establish a healthy relationship with his Aunt Clara, and improve his performance in school. Jim is doing much better now, and we've helped him to avoid a downward spiral by intervening early enough to allow him to get his life back on track so that he can have success over the long term and not become disabled. Expecting a kid like Jim to handle a life-changing event such as the death of a parent without professional help is simply unfair, and by investing in such resources, we all benefit as lives are changed, communities are safer, and taxpayers spend less money over the long term. Thank you for all your time and effort focused on this issue, and I'd be happy to answer any questions you have.
Any questions for Dr. Burkett? I don't see any, so thank you for your testimony. We have one final testifier. Connie Hayes is superintendent of Northeast Metro 916 School District.
Yes.
Welcome to the committee.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members. My name is Connie Hayes. I'm superintendent of Northeast Metro 916 Intermediate School District. We are officed in White Bear Lake. We serve 10 member districts and about 15 other non-member districts. I'm here to urge your support for the school-linked mental health grants. In the 7 years that I've been superintendent at 916, I've seen a dramatic rise in the numbers of students enrolled who not only have a disability, but who are also seriously mentally ill. Some come to us with multiple mental health diagnoses. Many are taking psychotropic drugs, and most have not seen a physician or a psychiatrist to monitor the effectiveness of those powerful medications. Most have not been involved in necessary psychological counseling to treat their mental illnesses. Some become violent towards others. Some are self-injurious. Some show extreme anxious behavior, and some are in the depths of clinical depression. To watch a young person experience an episode brought on by their mental illness is heartbreaking. I hope none of you ever have to witness one of these episodes in our schools or with a family member or with a friend. It is absolutely tragic. Those are the special education students we see at 916. Yet our staff are educators. They are teachers, educational assistants, school psychologists, school social workers. Their job is supposed to meet the educational needs of the students they see. That is what their training prepared them for. Yet so many of our students we see at 916 have been emotionally unavailable a great deal of the time to learn. Just imagine a teacher saying to you in the hallway, "I had a pretty good day today. I actually got to teach reading for about a half hour." Well, we're having a few more of those good days at 916 than we did 7 years ago when I started. And why? Well, in part because of the schooling mental health grants that have been brought, that brought in clinical therapies into some of our programs. So for a year's worth of data, let me share this. 89 students in that year received clinical therapies. For 60% of them, this was their very first time to receive any of those therapies. Over 1,000 individual therapy meetings took place, as well as care coordination, parent consultation, family therapy, teacher consultation, diagnostic assessment, and school consultation. All that was done through the school-linked mental health grant. Did it make a difference? Is it making a difference? A resounding yes. As a result of those therapies, 75% of the 916 students enrolled in those therapies showed improvement or maintained their level of functioning as measured by an instrument called the Child and Adolescent Service Intensity Instrument, something called CASI. We need more of these therapists at our three intermediate districts in the metropolitan area. These are the children and youth who have the greatest unmet needs in our state. Some of you may have heard one or more of our stories that we face with the extreme violent behavior of our students, and this is putting other students and our staff at risk. But I want to tell you, these are not throwaway kids. Many of them are very bright and have the intellectual capacity to learn. If through appropriate therapeutic help, they can become emotionally available for our teachers to prepare them academically. But the students at 916 are not the whole story. Personally, I hope to see a decrease in the number of kids referred to the intermediate districts before I finish my career as a superintendent. I believe that making these grants more available around the state sets the condition for that to take place. I also would urge you to visit the Association for Metropolitan School Districts website to find several videos of families and speakers that we had at our mental health conference at the end of November. One of those speakers, a doctor, said that early intervention with children when they are experiencing early symptoms of mental health challenges can positively impact the physiological development of the brain. When treated at early onset, we are more likely to prevent the illness from becoming a lifelong challenge for these young people. These grants have already made a great difference. We can see the result at 916. We hear it from our families and we hear it from our staff. We already have a working model in Minnesota for these therapies to be embedded in our schools. Please support an increase in the school-linked mental health grants so that more children in our great state of Minnesota have a chance for that healthy brain development and a life full of happiness and joy where they can contribute to family, church, community, and places of work. Thank you for your consideration.
Thank you very much for your testimony, and we have a question from Representative Gernhagen.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for your testimony, Superintendent Hayes. And yeah, I was a longtime school board member, and No, there's a little ribbing going on here.
16 years.
Yeah. From my observation, I think there's merit in the testimony here, and obviously you've had very positive experience. One of the concerns I see is that medicating young children seems to be the quick, easy answer so many times to some of these problems. And, from my perspective, I do think parents should be made aware of the potential negative consequences of medicating young children. And now we're talking even going into the preschool in some cases, for a long period of time. I have a nephew who is special ed, and he clearly has some problems. I mean, that are observable facts. But in some cases, some of these children, from my observation, they're put on this medication, and it's some of the criteria seems to be a little bit subjective. And I always, as a school board member, try to insist that we give full disclosure of the potential negative consequences of long-term medicating of children, along with other alternatives that might be available to address this prior than just the quick medication. So the question is, do you see, in your experience, a concern in this area, and would you like to see some stronger requirements as far as disclosing to parents the potential negative effects of long-term psychotropic drugs on their children and possible other alternatives before medication is tried right away?
Ms. Hayes.
It might take an hour, I know.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, I can't disagree with anything you've said. Those decisions are made between parents and their physicians. What we see for the children that are referred to our programs, that many times, for whatever reason, they're not being followed by a physician or a psychiatrist, whether it be access. I don't know the answer to that, but certainly we would like to see a stronger team approach with parents, physicians, and psychiatrists specifically on the issue of medication, so that when medications are deemed necessary, that we work as a team and we monitor the progress and how well it's working. Far too often that probably does not happen.
Representative Grunhagen.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. Do you think this bill will help in that process?
Ms. Hayes. Somebody else. Like
Mr. Chair, Representative, I think probably the best response I can give to that is by bringing the clinical therapies into the school, we're going to have a stronger connection to the medical community for the medical needs that these students have. So it strengthens the team, and those clinicians do offer a segue between the families and the psychiatrists who are going to be prescribing those medications. So my intuition tells me that with that stronger team effort that it should get better over time, but I don't have any evidence of that as yet.
I will say we had testimony in Representative Liebling's committee, and I don't remember which bill it was, but there was a mental health professional from the Wilder Foundation who was stationed in a school, and turned out that she was sort of the medical care manager or the health care home person for some of those kids, because there was not good communication between the psychiatrists and the primary care physicians, and she was sort of managing the whole thing with those kids, which I think is really the way to go.
And Mr. Chair? Additionally, one of the dimensions of service that the grant supports is that mental health professional being able to consult with school staff, so that this is how you can help Johnny be more successful in the classroom, in the hallway, on the playground, wherever. The third-party reimbursement won't pay for those services. They'll pay for the 45 minutes with Johnny in the office. They won't pay for the consultative services that can be so valuable for the children.
Okay. And next we have Representative McDonald.
Mr. Chairman, I think we're in lieu of...
The guy was going to give you a shot has just left.
Oh, yeah. Thanks, Grunhagen. No, in lieu of time, are we out of time? I can hold.
We're running out of time.
I will end my question then. We'll
okay. Thank you. And Representative Loeffler.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. I was just going to say I'm the author of the bill that you mentioned, but I must say that we're all working with Sue Abderholden and others, the education system, to try and build a supportive set of things that will work together to make sure we have that coordinated care. I think they tried to make sure that all of us had a piece of the action, but I think in this committee we're going to be able to put all the pieces of the puzzle together, and I think we look forward to that.
Thank you for your testimony, and thank you, Representative Dabney. And House File 353 is laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus.
Or certain. thank you very much, Mr. Chair and members.
The meeting is adjourned.